The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
It is in honor of Martin Luther King Jr. And the title of the talk is The Dharma of Martin Luther King Jr. And I offer the teachings, actually MLK's teachings, through Nikki's voice with humility, because I cannot do justice to the power and depth of this amazing human being that lived on this earth and walked this earth and taught and left this amazing legacy in this work that he did. So for any shortcomings of the transmission, I ask for your forgiveness. I'm going to do my best to channel this amazing human being's teachings. And when I was reflecting, there are so many teachings that are actually Dharma teachings, so many things that he taught. And I was looking at the website of the King Center, and I wanted to share some of the things. In fact, I wanted to start with the six principles of nonviolence that he wrote as part of Dr. King's philosophy of nonviolence, and with each principle, each of the six principles, I wanted to relate it to the Dharma teachings, because I think they are Dharma teachings. They're really powerful Dharma teachings, really, really powerful. So the six principles of nonviolence were first apparently described in his first book, Stride Toward Freedom. And the six principles are, number one, principle one, nonviolence is a way of life for courageous people. Let's take that in for a moment. Nonviolence is a way of life for courageous people. It's not for timid people. It takes a lot of courage and power to be nonviolent. And his teachings, actually, one thing that has amazed me both about his teachings and his actions, there is so much love, nonviolence, and so much strength, so much power. It's not a weak love, it's a strong, powerful love. I want to read for you, if I may, part of his writing. And you'll get a sense of how this act of nonviolence, how powerful, how courageous it is. To our most bitter opponents, we say, we shall match your capacity to inflict suffering by our capacity to endure suffering. We shall meet your physical force with soul force. Do to us what you will, and we shall continue to love you. We cannot in all good conscience obey your unjust laws, because non-cooperation with evil is as much a moral obligation as is cooperation with good. Throw us in jail and we shall still love you. Bomb our homes and threaten our children and we shall still love you. Send your hooded perpetrators of violence into our communities at the midnight hour and beat us and leave us half dead, and we shall still love you. But be assured that we will wear you down by our capacity to suffer. One day we shall win freedom, but not only for ourselves. We shall so appeal to your heart and conscience that we shall win you in the process, and our victory will be a double victory. The first time I heard that, every time I still read it, it moves me. We'll still love you. We shall still love you. This is courageous nonviolence. This is not timid. And this is the best example, I think, of one of the Buddha's teachings, actually. So one of Buddha's very actually challenging teachings about love, about loving kindness, shows up in a sutta, in one of his teachings called the Simile of the Saw. It's a beautiful long sutta, and at the end it culminates and it says, if bandits, so the Buddha is addressing his followers, he says, if bandits were to sever you savagely, limb by limb, with a two-handed saw, you got that? It's pretty graphic. If bandits were to sever you savagely, limb by limb, with a two-handed saw, he who gave rise to a mind of hate towards them would not be carrying out my teaching. Wow. That's a pretty high bar. And in the past, when I've taught that teaching, that sutta, I've gone through the whole sutta, and at the end I've taught that, people have said, is that possible? I mean, really? Is that possible? And I've shared some examples. And today, when I read this quote again by Dr. Martin Luther King, it is possible. That is exactly what he's teaching, right? It's radical. It's completely radical. It's courageous. Throw us in jail and we shall still love you. Bomb our homes and threaten our children and we shall still love you. Send your hooded perpetrators of violence into our community at midnight hour to beat us and leave us half dead and we shall still love you. You see the similarity? It's pure Dharma. It's pure Dharma, and it's possible. This is what he was teaching. This is what his followers were doing. Principle two. We're just getting started. Principle two. Nonviolence seeks to win friendship and understanding. The end result of nonviolence is redemption and reconciliation. And the purpose of nonviolence is the creation of the beloved community. And beloved community is a very specific term, which I will actually come back to at the end of the talk. I want to talk a lot more about what he means by beloved community, because that is actually the goal of nonviolence, his nonviolent teaching, is the creation of beloved community that includes everyone. But regarding the first two points of this second principle, so the goal being friendship, understanding, redemption, and reconciliation, I'd like to share another passage from one of his sermons called Love Your Enemies. And he goes, another way to love your enemies is this: when the opportunity presents itself for you to defeat your enemy, that is the time which you must not do it. There will come a time, in many instances, when the person who hates you most, the person who has misused you, the person who has gossiped about you most, the person who has spread false rumors about you most, there will come a time when you will have an opportunity to defeat that person. It might be in terms of a recommendation for a job. It might be in terms of helping that person to make some move in life. That's the time you must do it. That is the meaning of love. In the final analysis, love is not the sentimental something that we talk about. It's not merely an emotional something. Love is creative, understanding goodwill for all men. It is the refusal to defeat any individual. When you rise to the level of love, of its great beauty and power, you seek only to defeat evil systems, individuals who happen to be caught up in that system you love, but you seek to defeat the system. That is a radical teaching. And again, so many things to share and appreciate about his teaching. One is that the internal and the external dimension of practice. So the internal dimension is cultivating this love that is universal, is not sentimental, is agape, is goodwill. It's goodwill for all humankind. So it's a practice. It's the same practice that we call in Buddhism, we call metta, loving kindness. It's this cultivation of goodwill for all beings, regardless of whatever, whoever they are, whatever they are. So it's the internal aspect of the practice cultivation. And then the external is when push comes to shove, right? When this person who has spread rumors about you, the person who has done you ill, in that moment externally, what do you do? What action do you take in the world? I mean, really ask yourself for a moment. What would I do? Can I have that courage? Can I have that courage? Or can I be inspired to one day to live with that courage, to love, and live up to that? To that inspiration. These are pretty radical teachings, and there might be a part of you like, no, this doesn't work. We'll get to that in a little bit. But principle 3. Nonviolence seeks to defeat injustice, not people. Nonviolence recognizes that all evildoers, by the way, this is the terminology used in his teachings. Here we don't so much use the terminology of evil. It's more unwholesome, you know, things that if you knew better you wouldn't do, right? You would do something more wholesome. But I will be sharing his terminology and then kind of translating. So nonviolence recognizes that evildoers are also victims and are not evil people. The nonviolent resistor seeks to defeat evil, not people. So many interesting things here. Again, it's the same understanding, it's the same teaching that in Buddhism. There are no evil or bad people. We're all a mix of wholesome and unwholesome actions and deeds and thoughts, right? And our practice is to recognize the roots that cause unwholesome actions and deeds and thoughts and words, greed, hatred, and delusion. Those three. And what are those three? They sound really like hoity-toity. Greed, wanting, like, oh, I want this. I really, really want that. Oh. Hatred. Oh, no, hatred. I mean, that kind of the... And everything that's related to hatred. Envy, jealousy, etc. There's so many aspects of anger, etc. Hatred, pushing away. And so greed, hatred, and delusion. What's this delusion thing? People often ask. Well, actually, delusion, I like another translation of it, which is ignorance or confusion. And that is not knowing any better. And that root, that is the root of the other two. When your mind doesn't know any better, when you have dust in your eyes, as the teachings say, when you don't see very clearly, then that gives rise to greed and hatred. So when there's greed and hatred, confusion is always present. Because if there was clarity, when there was wisdom, if there is wisdom, there wouldn't be neither greed nor hatred. It would be the opposite of greed and hatred. The opposite of greed is letting go, generosity. The opposite of hatred is love, metta, which we're talking about. And the opposite of ignorance delusion is wisdom. So when wisdom presents, you know better, you see better. You know what the right action is instead of either having greed or hatred. So similarly, the teachings it's not the idea that people are good or bad inherently, is that we all potentially have the roots of unwholesome actions in us. And through the training, through mindfulness training, to actually see what is happening in our minds, what is happening. Is there greed? Is there hatred? Is there confusion? Is there wisdom? That we get to train ourselves. We get to train ourselves more and more and more for the tendency to have more tendency towards wholesome instead of unwholesome actions that cause harm to us and to others in different ways. Another aspect of this principle three is that, as it's put, evildoers are also victims, and that's an interesting aspect, because unwholesome acts without ethical clarity erode the peace of the person who commits them. So one becomes a victim. Have you noticed when, for example, you're angry or when you do something that you're not quite really proud of, or you do an act that later you regret? Who loses the peace? Who stays up? Who can't forgive themselves, etc., etc., right? It's the person who actually conducts the unwholesome act. It lives somewhere in our bodies, it continues to live in our minds. So the people who actually do the unwholesome acts, in his language, the evildoers, are also victims. Martin Luther King says, "I have decided to stick with love. Hate is too great a burden to bear." I love that. Hate is too great a burden to bear. It is too great a burden. Have you noticed when hatred arises for you, for someone you know or someone in politics, like, does it feel good? No, of course not. It's a burden. Hatred is a burden. It burns. Hatred is a burden. Hatred destroys you. It makes you ugly internally and externally. It takes your peace away. It makes you less than the full human that you are. It's a torment. Principle four. Now, this is an interesting one. Nonviolence holds that suffering can educate then and transform. Did you see that? Did you notice that word? Nonviolence holds that suffering can educate and transform. Nonviolence accepts suffering without retaliation. Unearned suffering is redemptive and has tremendous educational and transforming possibilities. I've heard that word suffering somewhere before, have you? Maybe in the Four Noble Truths, like the main teaching of Buddhism. That there is suffering in life, right? The First Noble Truth. There is suffering. There's a cause of suffering. There's an end to suffering. And there's a path to the cessation of suffering. So, and it all starts from seeing the transformative value of suffering. And to say suffering on its own may not be transformative, right? Because there are people who suffer and become hurt, and they hurt others because they don't see the transformational value of suffering, that it is universal. Oh, I hurt, ouch. That means that you hurt too. You can hurt too the same way I hurt, etc., etc. So suffering can be transformational if one sees the transformational value of it, not just thinks, oh, why me? I'm suffering. Oh, I need to go and, you know, beat other people because they hurt me. You know, there are ways in which suffering can be transformational and educational if one really sees it. And again, that's another aspect of the teaching that really was interesting for me, that in the teachings of Martin Luther King, as far as I see and understand it, the value of suffering, it does educate and transform the whole system. And in this case, suffering is accepted without retaliation, as in the quote that I read earlier. Yeah, suffering. And another, I think, similarity is that, you know, traditionally people, human beings, try to avoid suffering. Like, suffering doesn't seem like a good thing. We want to get away from it as much as possible. And again, in the teachings in our tradition, in Buddhism in general, there is value to suffering. There is value if you recognize it. If you recognize the transformative value of it, and to see the universality of it, that it is part of life. You haven't done anything wrong. You're not bad. This is just part of being human. There's difficulty in it, and there are ways in which to, for example, to transform suffering into compassion or into wisdom. Principle number 5, nonviolence chooses love instead of hate. Nonviolence resists violence of the spirit as well as the body. Nonviolent love is spontaneous, unmotivated, unselfish, and creative. So this principle really emphasizes what has been iterated over and over, choosing love instead of hate. And it's interesting, I found this quote by Martin Luther King that says, "Darkness cannot drive out darkness. Only light can do that. Hate cannot drive out hate. Only love can do that." And that is a paraphrase. It's a beautiful paraphrase of the first verse of the Buddha in the Dhammapada, which is, "Hatred never ceases by hatred, but by love alone it's healed. This is an ancient and eternal law." So principle 5 turns out to be one of the main teachings of the Buddha. And I want to tell you a personal story about this particular quote, "Hatred never ceases by hatred, but by love alone is healed. This is an ancient and eternal law." So about, I think maybe 25 years ago or so, I was traveling in Japan, and this is before I had started practicing Buddhism, and I was in the temple in Nara, and walking around sightseeing, and there was a plaque. There was a plaque there that had these words on it in Japanese, and then in English. Said, "Hatred never ceases by hatred, but by love alone is healed. This is an ancient and eternal law." And I'd never heard that before. It had never occurred to me, this concept, that hatred never ceases by hatred. It is so true. It's the universal law. And at that age, it had never occurred to me that this is true. And it hit me. I remember writing it down in the back of the postcard and bringing it home and just being so impressed. That was one of my first exposures to Buddhism. And if there's only one teaching that we remember and we enact, hatred never ceases through hatred. It's only by love alone that it is healed. Just remembering that. If you only remember one thing from this whole talk tonight, if it's just that, I think we've done pretty well. Principle 6. Nonviolence believes that the universe is on the side of justice. The nonviolent resistor has deep faith that justice will eventually win. Nonviolence believes that God is a God of justice. And this, again, this principle, I think, is quite a radical and important assertion about the fabric of the universe, that the universe is just, is good. And there are different ways to think about this assertion, which is pretty radical, and just really depending on how we make this assertion and what kind of subtle assertion we live with can really determine our attitude in life in general. Einstein relates it actually in the same principle in a very, very clear way. He says, and by the way, Einstein used to be my hero growing up. I was a nerd, still am. The most important question, he says, the most important question you can ever ask is if the world is a friendly place. For if we decide that the universe is an unfriendly place, then we will use our technology, our scientific discoveries, and our natural resources to achieve safety and power by creating bigger walls to keep out the unfriendliness and bigger weapons to destroy all that which is unfriendly. And I believe that we are getting to a place where technology is powerful enough that we may either completely isolate or destroy ourselves in this process. He goes on to say, if we decide that the universe is neither friendly nor unfriendly, and that God is essentially playing dice with the universe. That's where his famous quote comes from. That God is essentially playing dice with the universe, so it's random. Then we are simply victims to the random toss of the dice, and our lives have no real purpose or meaning. And he concludes, but if we decide that the universe is a friendly place, that we will use our technology, our scientific discoveries, and our natural resources to create tools and models for understanding that universe, because power and safety will come through understanding its workings and its motives. So again, as he says, the most important question we can ever ask is if the world is a friendly place. And that's similar. It's the assertion. So depending on what our personal orientation is, what do we assume the universe is? Friendly, unfriendly? Is the fabric of the universe compassion and love? Is it an unfriendly, cold place that everybody's out there to get us? Like, or is it just random? It's all random. What is our assertion? What is our internal, unexamined assertion of what the fabric of this world, this life, this mystery that we live in, what is the essence of it? If you haven't asked yourself this question, please do. It's an important one. I like to talk about the beloved community, which I left a bookmark earlier on, and it was part of Principle 2, I believe. Or was it? Yes, Principle 2. The purpose of nonviolence is the creation of beloved community. So in the time left, I want to tell you about what I understand to be this culmination of this nonviolent practice. So apparently the term beloved community was first coined in the early days of the 20th century by philosopher-theologian Josiah Royce, who founded the Fellowship of Reconciliation. But Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., who was actually a member of this Fellowship of Reconciliation, popularized the term and invested it with much deeper meaning and has captured the imagination of people of goodwill all over the world. So the idea of beloved community is not such a lofty utopian goal, but it's actually something that's considered to be quite achievable if critical mass of people committed to it and were trained in the philosophy and methods of nonviolence. So I'll read a couple of paragraphs from the King Center website. So Dr. King's beloved community is a global vision in which all people can share in the wealth of the earth. In the beloved community, poverty, hunger, and homelessness will not be tolerated because international standards of human decency will not allow it. Racism and all forms of discrimination, bigotry, and prejudice will be replaced by an all-inclusive spirit of sisterhood and brotherhood. In the beloved community, international disputes will be resolved by peaceful conflict resolution and reconciliation of adversaries instead of military power. Love and trust will triumph over fear and hatred. Peace with justice will prevail over war and military conflict. The beloved community is not devoid of interpersonal, actually this is very important, I think the next paragraph, is not devoid of interpersonal group or international conflict. I mean, you can't avoid conflict in human interactions, right? So this beloved community does have conflict. Of course it has conflict. Instead, Dr. King recognized that conflict was an inevitable part of human experience. But he believed that conflicts should be resolved peacefully and adversaries could be reconciled through a mutual, determined commitment to nonviolence. No conflict, he believed, need erupt in violence, and all conflicts in the beloved community should end with reconciliation of adversaries cooperating together in the spirit of goodwill. So as an example of this, in 1956, when Dr. King spoke of the beloved community as an end goal of nonviolent boycotts, he, at a victory rally following the announcement of favorable U.S. Supreme Court decision desegregating the seats of Montgomery buses, he said, "The end is reconciliation. The end is redemption. The end is the creation of the beloved community. This is the type of spirit and this type of love that can transform opponents into friends. It is this type of understanding goodwill that will transform the deep gloom of old age into the exuberant gladness of the new age. It is this love which will bring about miracles in the hearts of men." And one last quote I wanted to share. "The aftermath of nonviolence is the creation of beloved community. The aftermath of nonviolence is redemption. The aftermath of nonviolence is reconciliation. The aftermath of violence is emptiness and bitterness." So the idea again, well actually no, I lied. There's one more quote I want to share with you, which I think is quite beautiful. All right, the last quote I want to share is, "I do not think of political power as an end. Neither do I think of economic power as an end. They are ingredients in the objective that we seek in life. And I think that end of that objective is a truly brotherly society, the creation of a beloved community." And that is the vision I would like to share with you. And that's the vision that is inspiring. Because yes, technological advancement, political power, economic power, this and that, but all for what? For what? Why? Why? And I think as individuals, as practitioners, both engaging in internal practice and external practice in the world, to ask a question: what is the objective? Why? What is our perspective? How do we see the world? What is the goal? It all relates to greed, hatred, confusion, all of that, just to see that both in ourselves. What is it that we really want? What is it that we're training ourselves for? Are we training ourselves for more greed, more hatred, more power, more this, more that? What are we training ourselves for? And of course, you're practitioners, you're here. So you are practicing. You have aligned yourself as much as possible, as much as it's available to you right now, with your highest intentions of cultivating kindness, cultivating goodwill, cultivating mindfulness to see the greed and hatred and delusion that we all have. Of course we all have. But just start to see it, to start to see it more and more, as much as possible, and to keep the vision of beloved community. It's quite a vision. So I'd like to invite us to just sit for a few moments with that, with the vision of a beloved community at some point, hopefully maybe in this humanity's life. Thank you for your kind attention. I hope there was something tonight that was of useful reflection for you. And whatever wasn't useful, let it go. Thank you.